Hello, and welcome to another conversation from the Child Health Advisory Council and Career Physician. We are a group of former leaders and chiefs and chairs who are committed to passing on our experience and wisdom to the next generation of pediatric leaders and pediatricians. I'm Bruder Stapleton, chair of the Child Health Advisory Council. Other council members are Christine Gleason, Craig Hillemeyer, Renee Jenkins, Danielle LaRocca-Rina, Valerie Opapari, Bruce Rubin, Robert Sowen, Arnold Strauss, and Wesley Millican, the CEO of Career Physician, as well as John Hayes. Please visit careerphysician.com to review our leadership material and other conversations. And now, welcome to today's Insight Conversation. We wanted to today to talk a little bit about the candidate's perspective in the new age of accountability and the challenges of research funding. And what questions did we hear from candidates that were most important to them when they were considering a position? Danielle, what would you say were some of the most key questions that candidates ask you in pursuing a career, a new opportunity?
Thank you, Bruder, for that question. And I was reflecting back both in my roles as medical director, then division chief, and then chair, the kinds of questions that I got from folks. And it really varied depending on the job description that they were responding to. So I'm going to segment that question out. So if I was recruiting a clinician researcher, clinician scientist, the question was the distribution of their time and their effort with respect to research time and protected time. And it was something that we would have thought about ahead of time of, do you give someone who is really research focused but is in a clinical discipline such as pediatrics, general academic peds is my area, child abuse pediatrics is my area as well. You know, do you have protected time for 2 to 3 years before you submit your K award, et cetera, and what happens in the transition? So it's really the distribution of clinical time, the distribution of research and support. And of course, if you were recruiting someone from out of town, they really wanted to get a sense of the culture of how supportive. And that may have come from me, but very importantly, would have come from their interaction with other members of the department that were their peers. I think the thoughtfulness about whether the move made sense for their family, that work-life balance, and then what their career goals. I know that it depended if folks were more clinically oriented, I tended to get less questions about sort of promotion. But if they were in the tenure track, for example, or they were looking for promotion to associate professor, that time clock issue came up a lot as well. So I know I didn't give you one answer because it's a complicated first step when someone is accepting their first faculty position, but it's kind of matching what they have in their minds about that first position and what the job description actually is. And getting concordance of those two things, I think, was probably the most difficult in that conversation.
Thanks, Danielle. Bob? What were some of the key questions that you received when you were recruiting surgeons?
So I agree with Danielle that a lot of the conversation seems to focus around the clarity of the clinical obligation. And a lot of the conversations I've had with junior faculty candidates have been about their own personal needs and in that regard. And you know, with procedurally oriented specialties, sometimes there's concern that if they have too much non-clinical time, that they'll lose their clinical skills. So helping the candidate clarify in their own mind what that correct balance is, it's imperative, I think, that they remain clinically active in some capacity. You know, one of the challenges we face, all of us, I think, but especially in the procedurally oriented specialties, is that the NIH has pretty strict FTE requirements for K awardees, for example. And, you know, it's often difficult to convince a young surgeon that she or he would only be a 0.25 clinician and still be able to maintain that skill. So Having some clarity on that front end is, I agree with Danielle, probably the most frequent conversation. And I think I agree with her also that issue about mentorship, and particularly, again, if you're living in that clinical world and in that research world, do you have a mentor for your research, mentor for your clinical activity? And those are the most frequent and compelling conversations, I think.
To emphasize one aspect that hasn't been discussed as much, it was promotion. They always wanted to know what the criteria were and how quickly it would happen, how they would be able to work toward promotion, which I always found a little bit upsetting, because I was always wanted them to focus more on what they needed to get done to be successful, rather than focusing on this particular specific aspects of this is the three things I have to do to be promoted. So promotion was one, and then of course the distribution of time. And as Danielle mentioned, it was very different for those focused in research and the protected time, but everybody wanted protected time, and most of them didn't have a very good idea of what they would do with their so-called academic time. And so that was one of the issues that I always felt I had to clarify. This is what we expect with your 10 or 20% so-called academic time.
Thanks, Arnie. I'm going to ask Chris to speak about faculty tracks. That was one of the things that in my discussion with the recent grads that they found so variable. You know, what people use terms for clinician, academic clinician educator, physician scientist, and there's huge variability when they went from institution to institution.
Yeah, well, thank you, Bruder. I couldn't agree more. It was a big topic, I felt, of conversation in faculty recruits at whatever level, you know, leaders or new faculty coming in. And it more fit along the lines of questions that I thought the candidate should ask. And materials had been provided, usually, ahead of time to say what the different tracks were. And they should have been clear about what track they were being recruited for. But that wasn't always the case. And if they did ask questions about it, the most important thing I felt in answering the questions was to find out what they knew about it already. Like, what had it been, what were the tracks like at the institutions where they'd been, even as a trainee, or if they were more senior at the various institutions, what did it really mean if someone was a clinician educator or a clinician or, you know, and so forth. And you actually could put part-time in that also, you know, to address those kinds of issues. And I found that it was most useful in thinking about the questions and things that, you know, Bob and Arnie and Danielle have already indicated, that the questions that candidates would ask me, sort of the leader, and even if I was on a search committee and so forth, were often informed by the timing. Who had they met with prior to that, prior to meeting with me? Or if I met at the very end, maybe at the beginning of a search and then at the end of their recruitment visit, even on Zoom, there would be information that they might have gleaned from others or felt more comfortable asking for, you know, others that I could then respond to. And even in the old days when we used to do a second visit or even a third visit or something, where we could come back to those things. But I think you're right, thinking about the faculty tracks and making sure how that related then to promotion, although I agree with Arnie, how to be promoted and, you know, what mentorship they were going to have, what the support they were going to have and so forth, would have been nice if the focus was more on being successful and making sure they had the resources and the support they needed to be successful, and that I needed them to be successful in those roles and not necessarily just to be sure they could get promoted. That was the icing on the cake, but I know it meant a lot to the candidate.
Bruce, when you recruited faculty, what questions were you wanting them to be sure to ask you?
Well, thank you, Bruder. And first, I'd love to follow on with Christine. When we were recruiting faculty as chair, questions would come up with people that they met, and those would always be forwarded by email in advance of the meeting with me and the department administrator so that we could be prepared to answer. But I think the key questions that anybody needs to ask relate to alignment and resources, alignment of purpose, and this includes what beyond what perhaps the job description might say, what is going to be expected of you in this role, and what do you expect out of this role, and to make sure that those line up. And if you're looking at a leadership position, what are the people that you are leading expect of the leadership? Because that may be different from what the actual leadership of the department, who you're going to be reporting to, may be expecting. And once it's clarified, when you've asked the questions, when you've determined what are the key things that I need to be looking at right away, what are the expectations, you can then go back and say, what are the resources, be they mentorship, personnel, financial, time, that will be made available to me specifically to address those key purposes.
Great comments. Craig, what's been your experience?
Yeah, I think a lot of really good comments have been made. One of the things that I think is really important is the language that we use in talking about a successful recruitment. And the successful recruitment really is only good if it leads to a successful career. And that's really what we want to see in these individuals. And to have them look at it from the successful career perspective, I think, is something which is not always that easy to do. And the other thing I think is it's really important to make sure that they feel comfortable talking about issues that haven't come up that are concerning them. Because oftentimes these are people that don't have, they're afraid to ask questions. They think, well, if I ask that question, then it'll be used against me and they won't want me. And I just think it's really important to create an environment where they feel comfortable bringing up those things that are sort of there, making it so that that successful recruitment can't take place that'll lead to the successful career. And there are a lot of ways to do that. Questions that you can ask that are not, you know, leading questions, but that are very open-ended, that give them opportunities to really get those concerns out there on the table so you can begin to address those.
That's great. Well, these have been wonderful comments. I did a very short survey of four recent graduates of our program in Seattle and who are very successful fellows and junior faculty. And what I found was that regardless of the career pathway, each of them was interested in the culture of the institution. And that was manifest in questions about recent turnover, collaboration, wellness programs, mentorship. They also were very struck by the variability of the titles and tracks, and that it was really important for them to know what their career goals were and how that aligned with the career track they were being recruited to. And that related very specifically to time and resources, as Bruce said. The main issue was understanding the job that was being offered and understanding where your career matched that issue. That was continually listed as being very, very important.
The folks that we're recruiting, unless we're recruiting chairs who may be later on in their careers, are early career folks who are also developing their own interest and their families. And for me, as I listen to this, and Bob, I'm actually thinking of you because my daughter is a fifth year surgical resident about to start a fellowship in critical care and trauma. And what's missing from this conversation is alluded to short-term and long-term happiness and career. And dedication for the next 30 years means that you need to integrate whether you're going to have children or not, whether you're going to care for an ailing loved one. And how does a career trajectory where you're absolutely committed mesh with your life? I think perhaps for our next conversation, Bruder, and I hand it back to you. But I sense that that was not being asked. And we alluded to the fact that there are questions that folks are not comfortable asking because they might be judged by the question, not by the answers. So I would look to further conversation on how do we regard each other as human beings who are dedicated to our field, but also dedicated to our lives.
That was part of the culture question, you know, how this culture would allow them to have family time. And the other thing that they mentioned was how uncomfortable they were asking about salary. And they wished they had had more experience and training in negotiating and understanding both salaries and opportunities for transition costs, signing bonuses, things like that, that they were very uncomfortable talking about salary. I know I had to occasionally say, well, do you want to know what your salary is going to be? And so that's an interesting thing. Craig alluded to that. Well, everyone have a wonderful day. Thank you for listening. There are other conversations on the Career Physician website. We hope that you'll take time and look at some of those. Thank you.